Welcome to the Jacob's Well podcast. These messages are intended to feed you some great stuff that you can really dig your teeth into all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime, along with other great resources and ways to keep the conversation going at jacobs-well.net/leftovers. Enjoy the message.
We have our first guest today, who is the Minnesota State Commissioner of Human Rights. His name is Kevin Lindsay, and he was appointed by Governor Dayton in 2011, has been holding that office ever since, and he's got some great stuff to share with us, so we'd like to invite Commissioner Lindsay. Go ahead and have a seat. Well, thank you for being here, first of all. I know you're a busy man. It's budget time, so stealing a little bit of your Sunday morning is real special for us, so thanks
well,
much.
I appreciate getting a chance to see that photo of Groucho Marx. I had not seen him in such a long time.
Yeah, he's still around and doing well. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. So your office, okay, so I went and visited the commissioner this last week so we could kind of, you know, get to know each other and find out what's important to talk about. And I went to the Freeman Building, this huge building around the Capitol Plaza, and then all these big buildings and stuff like that. And then I meet you, and you lead me into your offices. And I thought, wow, I'm going to go in this great big division. And it's like, not that big of a space. I don't want to say it this way, but it wasn't that impressive. Not a lot of room for workers. And I got into your office and said, gee, I know senior pastors have nicer offices than this. You know, but yet your job, your office, the Department of Human Rights is responsible for compliance around hiring and practices for all the major contractors that work for the state of Minnesota. Then the same kind of things within all the employment of the state of Minnesota, and then also following on up all the leads, all the cases, human rights violations cases that come up, which is like 2,000 a year.
Yeah. So the work in which the department does. It's in three broad areas. The first is that we investigate charges.
There we go.
Investigate charges of discrimination. We also ensure that on state contracts that people have opportunities to work with those state contractors, and primarily people of color, women, individuals with disabilities. And the last thing that we're to do, and that's kind of the easiest one, is to educate and end discrimination and disparate outcomes in all walks of life in Minnesota. So, to your point, when you said you came into the office about 5 years ago for the department, and this was going around the country, is that there were a lot of states which were getting rid of human rights departments because they felt that we had gotten to a post-racial state and there wasn't really any work for departments of human rights to do around the country. And even in this state of Minnesota, the very first week on the job, I was told by the House that we could probably cut the budget by the department by 50%. The Senate said that they could cut the budget by 65%. Before the government shutdown, they both agreed that they had underestimated their starting point. So they wanted to cut the budget by 80% and then eliminate education outreach. And that's when the government shut down. So I figured things couldn't get any worse from there. The governor said that he disagreed with that. We weren't able to stave off all the cuts, but we managed to turn the lights back on after state government came back on, and we only had a cut of about 8%.
Yay. That's good news. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think if we learned anything in the last year, civil rights issues of all sorts, human rights issues, we're just sort of figuring out what they are all about and where all that is going on among us. So, and I understand, even though you've got a smaller staff, you've actually been able to have some major impact in terms of compliance on issues and having to bridge over more issues.
Well, I feel it's really been a very fortunate time. You were talking earlier about sort of the compassion for other. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm reminded sometimes of when I was a little kid and hearing the story of Jonah and the whale. And for those of you who don't know sort of Jonah and the whale, sort of the idea that Jonah doesn't want to go.
Yeah.
Because Jonah's supposed to carry this message, and God really wants him to go to these folks, And Jonah is like, I don't want to go to talk to these folks. They should know better, right? But God really wants him to go, and he sends a whale to convince him and swallows him, right? Spits him back out. So Jonah gets the message to go. So for me, there have been some times in which I've kind of thought of myself in some ways that I didn't necessarily want to go and talk to people as it relates to photo ID and why that had a disparate impact, and I'd have to tell them the story about people being denied the right to vote because they couldn't figure out how many jelly beans were in a jelly bean jar, or how many stars were in the sky, or what the names of all the judges were in counties. And there were people who didn't understand that history is that African Americans had been denied the right to vote because they couldn't answer those silly questions. And how the photo ID law might also impact people in the military from being able to vote, or people who took their husband's name and the paperwork wasn't always up to date, and therefore they might lose their right to vote. So it was one of those things where if you don't protect the rights of one, potentially you might impact the rights of others, and there has to be sort of an understanding of how we're all interconnected in that fabric of life.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's so many different areas that we have these conflicts over human rights, and I think all of us, well, most of us realize we're not in a post-bias era, and in fact, we're just starting to realize how deep those biases are. But nonetheless, it's just we can't chase it away. We can't figure out, in your work, what are you discovering? Are a lot of people, interested and willing to learn better practices and so on? Where are we stuck? What?
So I would say this. I think where we are within this respective work is we're in the stage of really repairing the relationship in the sense that folks can talk about sort of laws being changed back in the 60s, and there are some people who will talk about those laws actually being implemented and sort of regularly enforced. Reality is they have not really been enforced.
Yeah.
So one of the things when we talk to state contractors and we audit their respective work, we ask questions as it relates to, are you actually contacting schools? Are you actually contacting workforce providers? Are you actually meeting with people? And what we're finding is about a third of the time, they've written it down, but they're not actually talking to anyone. So when we get sort of messages from the legislature is that, you're haranguing people who have already been doing what they're supposed to be doing, and then we come back with data and we say, well, actually, they're not. And in a time in which people are unemployed and really looking for opportunities and looking for hope to find a job, that can be devastating for those communities.
I know I was still making jokes about the U.S. Bank Stadium, but that's been the biggest contract that the state has overseen in terms of compliance on inclusivity of hiring and so on. And you're talking earlier about some of the economic incentives and where the goal seemed impossible, and you're able to help people see that, no, this actually just plain makes sense. And did the governor, who elevated the percentage raise?
I appreciate you saying that as it relates to U.S. Bank Stadium. It is really huge. I do admit that you can see it from space. And
without a telescope.
Without a telescope, right. When I started as a commissioner of human rights, and the law allows a commissioner of human rights to set workforce participation goals in the area of construction. So for the state of Minnesota at that point in time, the workforce participation goals for people of color was 11%. So that meant 11% of the total number of hours worked by people of color on state projects, that would be the goal for contractors to meet. Just because it's a goal doesn't necessarily mean the contractors have to meet it, but it is a goal, and we do encourage them, and we try to provide a lot of resources. So what I had said was, in 2012, when the lights went back on for state government, that the goal should really be 32% for people of color. And a lot of people said, first off, there's not that many people of color in Hennepin County to be able to do that work. And I said, well, let's go to the parks, let's go to the store, let's walk around as it relates to the places where I'm hanging out, where you can see that most of the people who are teenagers or in their 20s are primarily people of color. And as someone who, at that time, I hadn't turned 50, but I was at an age where I could say, people who are 45 or older, they're not going into construction. And most of the people who are 45 or older in the state of Minnesota, are actually white, not of Hispanic origin. So the idea of this goal actually was sort of the direction of which we were going as a state. And there were a lot of pushback as relates to setting the goal at that point. And there were some people who said, well, even if you set the goal at that point, what that will mean is that all the other construction projects will drop below 11%. So where we are now in the story, U.S. Bank Stadium, the project there, 37% for people of color. And then for all the projects over 10,000 hours that we monitor, it's at over 29%.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it takes that kind of proactivity. So the state has these, I hate to call it quotas, but these standards that they're trying to meet in terms of inclusivity, and that would, you know, racial, gender, disability. I know you were telling people with criminal records and things like that. Is that common? Do most counties, municipalities, do most companies have standards like this?
Yeah, I would stay away from quotas, and here's why I'll say that. Now, I'll loop back to sort of Star Trek. I like that visual as it relates to Star Trek. How many people know why Star Trek was on the cutting edge of civil rights?
Because of the bridge.
No. Captain Kirk is involved in it. And everybody knows what Captain Kirk does every time he goes to a planet, right? There's a hand in the back, right? That's right. So Star Trek was the first ever interracial kiss on TV, and that was sort of groundbreaking as it relates to it. And that's kind of, you know, Captain Kirk's MO. He always finds a woman, whatever planet, right? He's not discriminating. That's what I love about it. But in that context of sort of like the 60s, the whole idea of the work which we were doing was somebody has to lose so somebody else could win. Okay, so the work that we're doing now, we really refer to it as workforce alignment. So like right now in the state of Minnesota, there's about 125,000, 150,000 jobs that are open and wanting because we don't have the right skill set for a person to be able to step into those positions. The other dynamic, which is very different from the 60s and 70s from the Star Trek period of time, is that the baby boomers were just going into the labor market, right? So what are the baby boomers doing now? They're exiting the labor market. Now, there's some people who are working longer, but for the most part, when we say that 25% of the people in the United States by 2042 will be 65 or older, we can't really rely on a lot of those individuals sticking around and being actively engaged in the workforce. And again, those numbers will primarily be made of individuals who identify as white, not of Hispanic origin. So when we look at sort of the people who are under 35, under 40, there actually should be job opportunities for all of them.
Yeah.
And it really now becomes incumbent upon us as a society to make sure that no child doesn't succeed fully in whatever career that they want. There should be a job opportunity for them in what they want to do.
And making sure we're preparing them as a society is so important. Last year, Brenda Castellas, who's a part of our community that in the department, the commissioner of education, has worked together with you on some of that. I want you to stick around. We got just a quick commercial break, and then I want to ask you another question or two, okay?
All right. I like the Star Trek, but I can't do what you did over there. I never could do that thing. Yeah. I appreciate it.
So one of the things that, I assume you're running into, and I know that we run into a lot, is this our unwillingness to admit that there is racial bias. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that we have this illusion that we're supposed to be perfect people, and part of the reasons we gather as a community is we know we aren't and can't be. In fact, that's not even the goal, but we do want to grow. So what are you running into with this inability for whether it's individuals or companies or, you know, the government agencies to own their racial bias or whatever the discriminatory biases are?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I wish there was a one-week seminar that we could run everybody through and then we would all be done with it. But unfortunately, that's really not the case. It's going to be a lot of conversations and dialogues. You had mentioned earlier about what we refer to as ban the box. So to the extent that someone with a criminal record goes to apply for a job, if the employment application asks them about criminal history information, That's no longer inappropriate in the state of Minnesota as a general rule. So one of the things when we talk to people about criminal background, we talk about the study by Professor Deva Pager. And Professor Pager, about 15 years ago, she did this study, white individual without a criminal conviction, white individual with a criminal conviction, black applicant with, black applicant without. Again, nobody's really surprised that the white applicant without a criminal conviction does better, 7 times better than the black applicant with a felony criminal conviction. But what was interesting in Professor Pager's study was that a white applicant without, or with a criminal conviction, white applicant with a criminal conviction, does better than the black applicant without a criminal conviction. And that was a study which has been replicated several times. And she was at the University of Chicago, I think, at the time. Now she's at Harvard. And she has gone and talked about this study and has done subsequent studies talking about how we look at criminal history information. So it's a twofold kind of impact. It's the impact as it relates to how we allocate our resources in the criminal justice area, but then how we look at that respective information. So to your point about race, when I talk to people about race, I say we understand that there are standards of conduct, but we hold people to different standards of conduct basis of race. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people have a very difficult time, even when presented with data, demonstrating disparate outcomes on that criminal history information. The other flip side on that, and I share this with folks, is that it's clear and evident that we have allocated our resources very different in the criminal justice area. So when I grew up in high school, I went to Schaumburg, Illinois, which was predominantly a white high school. The things that my high school friends did were no different than what my cousins did on the south and west side of Chicago, but they had very different life outcomes by the resources which were allocated by the police. And even when police picked individuals up, what those individuals could say, it didn't matter in the south and west side of Chicago. Things could be negotiated in Schaumburg.
Right. Well, when Philando Castile was shot and killed on July 6th, Governor Dayton on that day, you know, made a statement about that. He said that if Philando had been white, he would not have been shot. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is, it was a bold statement for him as a public official to make, but there was a lot of negative reaction to him. A lot of people say you should never, you know, shouldn't say that. It's anti-police, da, da, da. But it's the assumption is that it's wrong for us to say that we have bias. We haven't gotten rid of it. And I think Governor Dayton declined the interview, so I didn't get to ask him this question, but I think you know, he was saying, no, we just need to admit this. This isn't saying, our police are horrible or whatever. I mean, there's stuff that has to get fixed. This is something, a work in progress, and it's probably going to be for a long, long time. But until we admit that it is there and say, well, this is an actual consequence of that, we're not going to fix anything. We're just going to go around pretending and trying to find ways to make excuses for our behavior and for the problems we have as a society.
No, I think that that's right. I think we're at the point in time, sort of in the global relationship of race within our country, is sort of the acknowledgement that racism exists and bias exists. I think having leaders being courageous like Governor Dayton to be able to say that people who look like me may have bias is really important. And I think on the other side is that people like myself who look like me can say the fact that you have bias does not mean that I do not wish to work with you or partner with you. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to recognize that on the side. And that's the able to bring people together. And again, that goes back to what you were saying earlier about sort of unconditional love, right?
Yeah.
That's very difficult to sort of get people to that space though. And I was standing as close as you and I are standing right when the governor said that. It was very clear to me what he was saying, but I also was not naive and not understanding that there would be some people who would hear something very different.
Yeah.
But it was a very important step for us to take. I'm glad that he did it, and I'm hoping that we can continue on that dialogue and sort of set Minnesota on a course to be a leader within the entire country.
Well, we are very glad that You are heading up this department, and we have had the wisdom to hang on to the department. Those of you folks, if you hear about 80% budget cuts to the Department of Human Rights in the future, it's a good time to make phone calls and send emails and write letters so that doesn't happen, because there's some important work to be done yet. And thank you for being with us today.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you found this podcast valuable, please pass it along to others. And we'd love to hear from you, too. You can email us at info@jacobs-well.net or message Jacobs Well Minneapolis on Facebook. We see what we do as a community really making a difference for people. Since you're listening, you probably have, too. If you'd like to make a donation to support this work, you can find ways at jacobs-well.net/give. Thanks. Listen again next week or join us in person Sunday mornings at 10:30.